So we're going to continue our study of Sefer Shmuel Beis, and we're in Perek Yud Dalet, chapter 14. We're up to Pasuk Yud Ches, verse 18. And just to summarize the Perek up until now, so what happened was is that, unfortunately, Perek Yud Gimel was quite tragic, and that was a story of the rape of Tamar by her half-brother Amnon, and then Avshalom went ahead and murdered Amnon after 2 years, and Avshalom ran away, and he was away for 3 years, and Yoav kind of noticed that David was distressed, but Yoav was uncomfortable bringing up this with David directly, so he went and he sought the services of an Isha Chachama, a wise woman who came from the city of Tekoa, who was going to come, and Yoav basically gave her the talking points, but you know the delivery would be up to her to deliver a kind of message to David through telling a story, a type of parable, to get David to warm up to the idea of bringing Avshalom back. And we left off with the final psukim of her dialogue with David, and now David clearly has gotten the message. Some of us were a little bothered by the psukim seemed to be very wordy, specifically at the end. It seemed to be very kind of cloudy ways of getting the final points across. And so I have a little bit of an explanation to that, which we'll bring up in just a few minutes. So we're picking up with Pasuk Yud Ches. Vayan HaMelech, the king David answers back to her. Vayomer El Ha'ish, and he says to the woman, Al na sechachdi mimeni davar. Don't hide anything from me. Asher anuchi shoel osach, what I'm about to ask you. Batoma harisha yedaber na adoni hamelech, please let my lord the king, let him speak. So David is going to be out to David is suspect. Why is this woman the one who is trying to convince him to bring back Avshalom? He's never met this woman before. As far as he knows, she has no connection to Avshalom in the past. And therefore, she really has no vested interest in trying to reunite king and prince, father and son. So she must be working for someone. And David has his suspicions to whom she's working for. This phrase of Al na sesach di mimeni. So first, the word sesach di. So the Mitzvot Zion defines it as ha'alama, which is to hide or hidden. And this is a phrase which we've actually seen before. Whenever you're going to interrogate someone, you're going to ask someone, you don't want them to hold anything back, that's the phrase that you use. We saw it way back when, in Perek Gimel of Shmuel Aleph, when Eli, who was the shofet, when he was talking to his protege, Shmuel Hanavi, and Shmuel had received his very first nevuah. If you recall, it was like a whole, Shmuel didn't really understand that he was getting nevuah. There was a whole back and forth. And finally, the unfortunate circumstance was that Shmuel's first nevuah was about the downfall of his mentor's family, of Eli and his household. And so Eli was interrogating Shmuel the next morning, and Eli said, literally word for word, Al nos sachadim meni davar. Don't hold anything back. Eli took it a step further. Eli enlisted a type of curse against Shmuel if he would hold anything back, and Shmuel didn't hold anything back. Shmuel said exactly what it was. But this is kind of a Tanakh type of phrase when you're asking something of someone and you don't want them to hold anything back. So David was saying to this Isha Chachama, again, he doesn't know that she's from Tekoa, she never said that, but he's saying, don't hold anything back, what I'm about to ask you. And she says, of course, she has nothing to hide. She was not sworn to secrecy. I mean, in the words that we saw that Yoav, who was David's general when he enlisted her services, he never said, you know, at the end, you have to stay anonymous. At the end, you can't say that it was me. So she says, fine. Pasuk Yotes. Vayomer HaMelech, the Melech said, David says to her, Hayad Yoav Itach B'chol Zos, was the hand of Yoav with you in all of this? Did he put you up to this? Now, if you pause for a second, because, right, we have under the word b'chol zos, we have an asnachta, it's a semi-pause in the pasuk. What should she say? David asked a very directed question. Hayad Yoav itach b'chol zos. What should the answer be?
Yes.
Yes. That's it. Right? That's all she has to say to answer the question. And yet, here's her answer. Vatan ha'isha. The woman answered. Vatomer, and she said, Chinaf shecha adoni ha'melech. As your life lives, by your life, my master the king. Im ish lehemin lehasmil. The word ish here does not mean man. The Metzudat Tzion tells us that it's kind of a variation of the word yesh. Right? There's no yud in between. The aleph is taking the place. I'm not sure grammar-wise why it's happening, but it takes the place of a yud. So it's like im yesh. If there is lihamin to the right, ulhasmil or to the left, mikol asher diber adoni hamelech, from everything that my master the king has spoken. Meaning what you just said is spot on. It's not off to the right, not off to the left. Now remember, all David asked was Yoav behind this. Ki avdecha Yoav hu tzivani. It was your servant, Yoav, he was he who commanded me. Vehu sam v'fi shefchascha. He placed within the mouth of your maidservant, she's talking about herself in a humble way, is kol advar ma'ila, all of these things. And again, in parentheses, it's not that Yoav gave her a script, it's that he gave her the idea of the mashal, the idea of the talking points, and she ran with it. She's still speaking. Pasuk Chaf. L'ba'avur sabev es p'nei hadavar. It was, why did this all happen? Why did this all happen? It was to make a sabev. It was to kind of create the message in a roundabout way, as Pnei Adavar, this the face of the matter, meaning the goal of what we were talking about of this conversation, which was to try to convince you to bring back Avshalom. So it was done in a roundabout way. Asa avdecha Yoav es hadavar hazeh, your servant Yoav did this. Va'adoni chacham kechachmas malach elokim, and my master, meaning my lord, meaning you, the king, you are wise like an angel of God. Ladas eskala sheba eretz, to know everything that's in the earth, in the land. Meaning, on a first level, it's saying that you got it. You were right. You were right to think that it's Yoav. But it's kind of why are all these words necessary when David asked a very directed question. Was Yoav behind this? And she could have just said, yes, my master the king, Yoav was behind it. And we would have had a couple of less lines to learn today. So a question that we could ask is, why is she being so wordy?
Maybe she was afraid that if she just said yes, he would get angry. Like, he would get angry at her, at Yoav. But by saying it this way, A, she's complimenting him on his smart, you know, she's complimenting him and also just trying to.
So I think.
He wouldn't get angry at either of them.
I think we should just stop your answer by the first two words. I think she's afraid. Rav Bazak, in his Shiurim, he puts forth a theory that when people are very wordy,
it's almost like a
in the Tanakh, it's because they're a little fearful. And you can't, right? Sometimes just blabbing on is just some type of defense mechanism where you don't know what to say, so you keep talking because you're not sure if you said the right, if the words that you chose to say was right. So let me keep talking because maybe those will be the right words and that'll get me out of this situation. And that even though she was an Isha Chachama, this answers a little bit of what some of us were bothered by last week in terms of how wordy she was in giving over the parable, in that she was an Isha Chachama. But there's a difference between being an Isha Chachama in Tekoa and standing before the king trying to rebuke the king. I mean, it's not just that you're giving a presentation in front of it. You're trying to give a persuasive speech to the king that he should reaccept his son who murdered his other son and is now in hiding in a foreign land. And you're a stranger walking in with the task to do that. It could be a little daunting. And so in her presentation, she might have been a little wordy. And now in her response, again, she's being extra wordy because right here, now the king is demanding of her, I'm going to ask you something and don't hold anything back, right? And we all know, obviously, in our mind, we have David HaMelech, who is this, you know, the tzaddik and the righteous David HaMelech. And in the back of our heads, we have ancient times of a king that if you don't follow the king, you know, off with your head kind of approaches, which was not far. We know if someone's morid b'malchus, we've mentioned that many times. If someone, halakhically, if you rebel against the king, your life is on the line. So could that could be behind her response, and why it's so wordy when a simple answer of yes, it was Yoav would have been enough. Perhaps she's trying to lay it on. She mentions many times that's Avdecha Yoav, Avdecha Yoav, because at this point, anyone who's read ahead knows what David's reaction is going to be to the fact that, you know, he was kind of tricked into buying into the story. Well, at this point, if we stop, if we're being she has no idea, right? She didn't read the rest of the chapter. She doesn't know what David's reaction is going to be. That now he's figured out, maybe she's going to be punished, maybe she's going to be held accountable. So perhaps she's trying to, in a way, play the blame game, saying, "Don't look at me. Look at the one who sent me. It's all Yoav, Yoav, Yoav," to try to save herself. Pasuk Chaf Aleph. David does not, as far as we know, David does not answer back to her, and we don't hear from her again. This Isha Chachama, she remains an Isha Chachama.
And Yoav was standing there?
Presumably not.
Right.
Presumably not. And now David engages in conversation with Yoav. Now, you know, it could be that he was standing there.
Then why would he have asked him in front of Yoav?
Right. The question is, meaning to say that they were alone, that would be rather strange, right? For the king to just all of a sudden have an audience with a strange woman who's coming alone, that doesn't sound very, you know, definitely in the aftermath of Batsheva, you'd have to imagine that they would, first of all, David himself instituted something called Yichud, where there shouldn't be a man and woman shouldn't be alone. The question is, who else was listening? Meaning, if this is in front of the king's court, who else is listening? Is Yoav there? Is Yoav not there? That's something that we don't get to know. Now, if Yoav was standing right there, why wouldn't David turn to Yoav and say, "Yoav, did you put her up to this?" I don't know.
But this could have been later also.
This definitely could have been later, and it could have just been that Yoav wasn't there. If Yoav was kind of, I don't know. I think we would all imagine that this woman would do better in her job if Yoav is not standing over her, mm-hmm. right? If Yoav gave her what she needs to do and kind of lets her go on her own, that would be more, probably be more effective. Although I imagine, since we don't know, someone else could argue the other point, that Yoav might be thinking, "No, I better stay here and make sure she stays on point," and then, like, you know, keep giving her looks in the eye or keep giving her cues, what to say. So we don't know. So the only response after finding out that it's Yoav is Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Vayomer HaMelech El Yoav, the king, David, responds, says to Yoav, Hineina Asisi Es HaDavar Hazeh, behold, I have done this thing, V'lech Hashev Es Hanar Es Avshalom, go and return the young lad Avshalom. So on the phrase hinena asisi, behold, I have done. So there are two traditions in terms of what the word is. You might see on the side of your Tanakh or on the bottom there might be an asterisk. It might say the word asisa. The difference between the word asisi and asisa is very great. Asisi is I did something. Asisa is you did something. What's the thing? The thing here is some level. And we're going to see that it's some level of forgiveness of Avshalom. That David is saying, at least the way that we have it in our verse, Hineina Asisi, behold, I did this thing. I forgave Avshalom. Behold, I have forgiven Avshalom to the extent that you could go ahead and bring him back. But part of the reason why there's another tradition of Asisa is David is kind of hinting to the fact that it's really your doing. It's your doing of convincing me to go ahead and forgive Avshalom to some extent. Now, the great question that we're going to be thinking about is, does David do the right thing by forgiving Avshalom? Is the parable that the woman from Tekoa told David, does it really match up with what happened with Avshalom and Amnon? Right? The story that she said was about her two sons who were brothers. They went into the field. They started fighting. There was no one there to stop them, and one killed the other. And in that story, for all we know, if there was a real fight, and let's say son A killed son B, had the fight just gone a little bit of a different direction, son B could have killed son A. And it's almost the level of intent of the killing is rather questionable, right? Sometimes in a fight, you may think that you're just giving the final blow to a fight, but it was a knockout where you knocked the guy out in terms of, you know, one hit to the head too many, and a person, Maseches Makos talks about when they would give, when the Beis Din would administer lashes, they never wanted to give more lashes than the person could handle. It's not a death sentence. And that there was a concern that if you give an extra lash in the wrong time, if it's at the extent, if you kind of push the person to the limit, then an extra blow could kill. So in the situation of the two sons, it almost sounds like the level of intent might not have been so clear. In the case of Avshalom and Amnon, right? Avshalom basically spent 2 years planning this and carried it out. And so maybe the fact that David was compassionate to her story, maybe he should be compassionate to her story. Should he extend that compassion to Avshalom? Now the question then is going to be, he clearly is making the decision to extend the compassion to Avshalom. If you are going to extend the compassion to Avshalom, do you have to fully embrace him? What happens if you only partially embrace him? Is that effective at all? These are things that we definitely need to think about. But David is hinting to the idea that he's saying to Yoav, you know, it's your doing that I'm ready to make this, this step. Now Yoav, I don't think we mentioned this last time, but why did, just an approach that maybe I didn't say, is that why does Yoav choose the way of the parable to try to convince David of something? So it could just be that Yoav, because he was general, he remembered what had happened only recently in the story with Bathsheba, that when Nathan Hanavi came to David to try to rebuke him, Nathan also told a story. He told a story about the rich person and the poor person, and the poor person only had one sheep. And he saw that when you tell that type of story, David, like any human, leaves their emotional baggage on the side and looks objectively at the story. And then you could say, well, hey, that story is really you. And it was effective with David the first time, in terms of Nathan Hanavi. And so Yoav might be thinking, this is my chance to do in the same way. So Yoav, at this point, Yoav knows nothing of what the future is going to bring. All Yoav knows is that he had a plan to convince the king of something, and it worked. Pasuk Chav Beis. Vayipol Yoav el panav artza. Yoav falls on his face to the ground. Vayishtachvu, he bows down. Vayivarech haSamelech, he blesses the king. Vayomer Yoav, and he says, Hayom yada avdecha, ki matzasi chen be'enecha Adoni HaMelech. Today, your servant, meaning himself, knows that that I have found favor in your eyes, my master the king. Asher asa HaMelech asadav es devar avdecha, that you're doing the matter of your servant, that you're listening to my idea. And we had put forward a number of thoughts. Why was Yoav so insistent that Avshalom come back? So we said we put forth one idea that maybe Avshalom, as we'll see, is a pretty dangerous fellow, and Yoav would rather have a dangerous fellow under his watch than in a foreign country where who knows what's going to happen. Yoav might have also thought that Avshalom is clearly a powerful, influential figure, and for David's household, he needed that presence. Even if it came with some baggage, he needed that presence. And the third idea was kind of a personal thought, that if Yoav could convince David to publicly forgive Avshalom for performing a revenge type of killing, then maybe Yoav himself, who had himself performed a revenge type of killing when he killed Avner, Shaul's general, who had killed his brother, Asael, so maybe he would have some type of forgiveness in the eyes of David, in the eyes of society. So Yoav is overjoyed with the fact that the king is listening to him, And he expresses that thought to the king. Pasuk Chaf Gimel, Vayakam Yoav Vayelch Geshura. Yoav got up, he went to Geshur. Geshur was the foreign land that Avshalom was hiding in, because that was his maternal grandfather, was the king of Geshur. Vayave es Avshalom Yerushalayim. And he brought Avshalom to Yerushalayim. One would imagine that if the king made a decision to bring back Avshalom, then he would bring back Avshalom fully. He would grant him forgiveness. Now, should he make Avshalom the next? Should Avshalom be the heir to the throne? I think everyone can make an argument that he shouldn't be the heir to the throne. You can make the moral argument that even if you're going to forgive him, David has many sons. First of all, in the brackets, parentheses, we all know that David promised Bathsheba that her son would be king. We have no idea who else knows that, which is going to play out in the next few chapters. Who else does know that Shlomo is the crown prince? We know that Amnon was the oldest. Amnon was the oldest son. And so the question is why, the third son was Avshalom, so he's definitely closer in line to being king. So you would expect that if David's bringing him back, he would bring him back fully. If he doesn't want to forgive him, then he shouldn't bring him back at all, that he should leave him there. The complex emotions of David is that he seems to make the choice to do something in the middle, to bring Avshalom back, but not fully embrace him. Pasuk of Dalet. Vayomer HaMelech, the king says, he gives the instructions, presumably to Yoav, or to others to tell Yoav, Yisov El Beiso, that he should be taken around to his house. We had already described the makeup of the palace was that it seems that each child had their own living quarters, right? Because when it was described how Amnon wanted his sister Tamar to come, so it's they kind of had their own quarters. So presumably Avshalom also had his quarters, right? We had said that afterwards Tamar went and lived with Avshalom. So Yisov El Beiso, take him around back. I don't want him coming directly through the normal palace gates. Ufanai lo yireh, in my face he shouldn't see. Yisov Avshalom El Beiso, so they took Avshalom around the roundabout way to his home. Ufnei HaMelech Ura, and he didn't see the king. He didn't see the king on the day that he came back, and he didn't see the king going forward. The king refused to see Avshalom, which you have to imagine there's only a certain amount of time for that to stay quiet. Right? Here you are in the palace. One of the most prominent princes who has just spent 3 years being away from the palace is now back, and David won't have audience with him. David won't see him. David won't allow them to come in contact with each other. It just raises the question, what did David bring him back for? And there's no simple answer. You have to remember that it's very hard for us to put ourselves in the position of David, the emotions that are going on the one hand, he wants to forgive his son, on the other hand, his son did something that's unforgivable to a certain degree, right? And so David makes this like quasi decision, which ends up being really, really have really negative implications and outcomes, because we're going to flip the story, right? What are you thinking if you're Avshalom? If you're Avshalom and you've spent 3 years kind of out there, not being engaged, and now finally the flower of peace, whatever, some type of
branches.
The olive branch is being extended. So you think you're coming home, right? And if you're that son who's coming home to repair the relationship with father, you're probably thinking, you're dreaming of a hug, you're dreaming of some type, you're dreaming of a Yaakov and Yosef type of embrace, and you get the cold shoulder in a very public way. Mm-hmm. Because while obviously it's not in public, it is in public. Pasul Chafei is going to sound like a total tangent. It has to do with Avshalom, but it's going to sound like a total tangent, specifically because the Pasul Chafches, only a few psukim later, is going to tell us that Avshalom was in Yerushalayim for 2 years and he never saw his father. Which is basically where we left off, right? Vayisov Avshalom El Beiso Fanayim El Chlorah. He came back to his household and he didn't see his father. So we're going to have a small unit of psukim that are going to discuss the beauty, how handsome Avshalom was. And the Tanakh here goes above and beyond. And if you want, you can have a homework assignment. This may be the most descriptive psukim in all of Tanakh about someone's beauty. All right, we've had people described as beautiful, right? Eisha, Yafas Toar, Ma'od. We've had phrases like that, three or four phrases, maybe describing David had like five or six phrases. They would describe his complexion, how tall, all that. Here, listen to Avshalom. Pasuk Chaf Hei. And obviously, we have to be thinking, why in the world did the Tanakh put these psukim in, you could say, at all? And then you, secondarily, you would ask, why here? Pasuk Chaf Hei. Ucha Avshalom, and like Avshalom, lo hoya ish yafeh b'chol Yisrael lahalel ma'od. There was no other man as beautiful in all of Israel lahalel ma'od, to either to praise a lot, or it's kind of a phrase of saying worthy of praise, right? Worthy of, you know, lahavdal, you know, it's like the man of the year in terms of beauty. It's not just year, it's like all of his life. And the following description, mikaf raglo, from the bottom of his foot, the ad kad kado, until the top of his head, lo haya bo mum, there was no blemish, right? The modern advertising world would like us to believe that every model, male and female, under the sun, has nothing wrong with any part of their body. And the wonderful invention of Photoshop makes it that we could actually see a picture in advertisement, and anything, any little blemish can be taken away. We all think, and we fall for that everyone out there is perfect. But here, the way the Tanakh is describing Avshalom is he had nothing. He had no blemish. He was a perfect specimen of beauty from the bottom of his foot to the top of his head. Nothing. He, gorgeous, handsome, whatever you want to describe him. Now, Pasuk Chavav. Uvegalcho es rosho. When he would cut or shave his head. Vahaya miketz yamim li yamim. It was at the end of, the way to translate yamim li yamim in Tanakh is year. Right? We had that phrase way in the beginning. We had that phrase in Perek Aleph of Shmuel. I think we had it. Yeah, miyamim yamima. That when Elkanah, in Perek Aleph of Shmuel Aleph, when he would go to Shiloh, it says yamim yamima. When you have those phrases, yamim li yamim, that's the Tanakh's way of saying yearly. So vahaya miketz yamim li yamim, it was at the end of the year, asher yigalech, that he was shaving his hair. And why would he shave his hair? Ki chaved alav, it was heavy on him. Vigilcho, and he would cut it, shave it. Vishakal es sa'ar rosho, the hair on his head, the yearly amount of hair, had a certain weight. Matayim shkalim be'evin hamelech. It was 200 shkalim in terms of the king's measurement of weight. So the Torah Shebaal Peh is a little bothered, and Chazal were a little bothered by this pasuk. It seems to me there's like an elaborate ceremony of him shaving his head. Why would that happen? So the main tradition is that Avshalom was a Nazir basically his whole life. So if you're a Nazir your whole life, you're never going to cut your hair. At some point, the hair is going to get too heavy for your head. And so there was an allowance for him to shave once a year. Once a year, he would cut off all his hair and begin again. And this was an annual occurrence. And he goes ahead and he would weigh his hair, something maybe he would donate to the Mishkan, to Hektish. He would donate the value of his hair. According to some calculations, the Art Scroll note quotes that it was about 4 pounds of hair, which Sounds like a lot. If it's a lot, we understand why he wanted to cut it off. And then there's a clear focus on beauty, and there's a clear focus on hair. Why would there be such a focus on hair and on beauty? It might clue us into Avshalom not having the proper priorities, putting too much focus on something, right? The hair, out of all our parts of our hair, is the most external part of the body. It grows away from the body. It doesn't have the same, right? You have to teach this to a child before they get their first haircut, that it doesn't hurt to cut hair because it doesn't make any, right? If a three-year-old boy is going to have one of those upsharons, it's very important for parents to, like, the 3 months before, just drill the idea that it doesn't hurt, because you can make this whole big party and the kid's going to see scissors and run the other way. So, you know, I imagine it's the same thing for a girl's first hair, you know, any first haircut, right? We have to, and then we also have to teach them that you don't do this again. You don't, like, pass around scissors and have everyone cut your hair again. So it's a one-time thing. But the hair is so external. It's such an extra. And putting so much of an emphasis on it, it definitely highlights not necessarily the proper priorities. The third pasuk in this unit continues a little bit of mentioning the beauty, pasuk of Zion, where we're told, "Vayivaldu la'Avshalom shlosha vanim." Avshalom was born to Avshalom three sons, Uvas, Achas, and one daughter, Ushma. Her name was Tamar. Interestingly enough, he named her the same name as his sister, who's still alive. Right? We don't hear about Tamar, but she's still there. She's presumably still living in his household. And then we're told about this Tamar in terms of his daughter. He haisa isha yifas mares. She was also very beautiful. Now, the next pasuk is about to say that there's 2 years of time. It doesn't mean that he definitely had these four children in those 2 years. At some point in his, now, even though he was described as a nar, when David says, "Go bring back the nar," it could very well be that he was already married, that he already had children. At some point in his life, he had four children, but the Tanakh throws in the beauty aspect. So we're asking ourselves why is it so important for us to know that Avshalom is so beautiful, that is so handsome? And then the second question is, why is it important for us to know it here? So the Radak has a theory that, and here we're going to, right, this is a little bit of coming attractions. Avshalom is going to go on, and I imagine many of you have heard this before, it's not a shock. He's going to go on to lead a rebellion against his father. He's going to be the first of David's sons, unfortunately not the only of David's sons, to lead a rebellion. He is going to lead the most successful of the rebellions against David. And it's going to take up the majority of the next few chapters, next few prakim. Hey.
You didn't write it.
Exactly. So the Radak says this is the introduction to the rebellion of Avshalom, is the fact that he was more handsome than any other man in the country. So by definition, that means he was also the most handsome of David's sons. And so here he is thinking to himself that he very well might be the next king. He very well might be the next king, because while we don't like it, we know that physical appearance is a big part of leadership sometimes, and that someone who looks the part will sometimes get the people on board, even if they're not the best candidate, that looks can go ahead and do that. That was one of the reasons why that Shaul was described, when Shaul was first selected, he was told that he was taller and that he was handsome, that it has an impact, right? You're amongst your own subjects, that has an impact. In terms of foreign dignitaries coming and visit, you have, you know, it just has a, right? They say in job interviews, again, it's not, they say that if everyone's fully qualified and there's a taller person and a shorter person, the taller person is going to get the job. Whether that's right or wrong, that's not, you know, the shorter person lives longer. But the, you know, says the guy who's, you know, 6 feet. But the, The Radak says is that Avshalom's thinking his beauty will lead him to be the candidate to take over for David. But then he's going to see 2 years of being in the palace and having nothing to do with David. But he's going to think very highly of himself that it, for whatever reason, David's not choosing me, I can very well, I'll be able to go ahead and do, I'll be able to lead a rebellion. Does he know about Shlomo? Again, that's something that we remain in the unknown. We can have a theory that he did know, and that he thinks that his beauty is something that he'll be able to lead a successful rebellion. The only question that you have on the approach of the Radak is it the approach of the Radak sounds excellent. But if you were going to go with the approach of the Radak, you would most probably have it right before the next perek, right? We're still going, after here, we're going to circle back to the fact that Avshalom's in the palace and doesn't see David, and Avshalom's going to reach out to Yoav to try to get Yoav to broker an interaction with David, and it's going to work. And David and Avshalom are going to meet, and they're going to see each other. And then the next parak is going to launch his rebellion. So if you're going to have a number of psukim kind of be the introduction to the rebellion, you would perhaps just, you know, obviously they didn't type the Tanakh, but you know, you'd press enter a couple of paragraphs and have it go right before. The approach of the Abarbanel and Rav Bazak explains, obviously they're, one's a Rishon and one's a modern day thinker, so, but perhaps this is going to inform, these psukim inform David's decision, right? As on the one hand, David has a soft spot for Avshalom. On the other hand, David doesn't want to see him. Where does David's soft spot for Avshalom come from? Maybe it comes from his beauty. Maybe it comes that even David was affected by the outward appearance of Avshalom. That Avshalom was, because again, Avshalom's not just handsome. Avshalom, if the Tanakh, the way the Tanakh is describing him, he was so handsome. It was apparent to everyone who ever saw him. He was the perfect, right? And you have to imagine, it's not like the ugly high school kid who turns into a handsome adult at the 20-year reunion. You probably imagine that Avshalom was always that way. So, and even going, or Bazak takes it to the extent to say, you know, we see that what was David's downfall with Bathsheba? It was being attracted, right? He was from a rooftop looking down, and it was the beauty of the outward appearance that hooked David. And that could be David, part of David's being was that he was attracted to outward beauty, even in terms of his children, that he had a soft spot for Avshalom, so he's willing to bring him back. But at the same time, David is caught with the emotions of, well, this child, even though I have a soft spot for him, he did something that's really not forgivable. So if you explain that approach, then it makes good sense why it's right here. And the pasuk right before it says, Ufnei hamelech lo ra, and now we continue with pasuk ha'ches, Vayeshev Avshalom b'Yerushalayim shnasayim yomim. Avshalom was living back, had been living back in Yerushalayim for 2 years, Ufnei hamelech lo ra, and he still hasn't seen the king. And you kind of have to put yourself for a moment in Avshalom's mind. Every day that David doesn't invite him to see him, you have to imagine that the anger and the frustration is just building and building and building. Pasuk Chavtes, Vayishlach Avshalom El Yoav, Lishloach Oso El Hamelech. Avshalom sent messengers or a message to Yoav, Lishloach Oso El Hamelech, in order for Yoav to send Avshalom's message to the king. Now, in parentheses, we have no idea, did Yoav try other ways of getting to the king? And that just did Avshalom try other ways of getting to the king, and they just didn't work, right? I mean, because the possibilities are kind of endless. You can imagine Avshalom trying to walk into the king's chambers, and the guard stopping him at the door, and the embarrassment that comes from that. Maybe he tried sending letters. Maybe he tried other siblings, right? We don't know anything about those. The Tanakh doesn't tell us everything. It only tells us kind of what it's important to, for us to know, Avshalom definitely has a relationship with his sister Tamar. Maybe did Tamar ever try to entreat David? But what we have is Yoav. That Avshalom sends to Yoav that Yoav should try to get to the king. Why Yoav? So Avshalom, he might not know everything. Avshalom might not know about the Isha Chachama from Tekoa. He might not, but he knows that Yoav is involved because Yoav is the one who goes to Geshur to bring him back. So perhaps the highest official that he's ever had contact with since his return is Yoav. So that's where he can turn. But Pasuk continues, V'lo ava lavoi lav. But he did not want to come to him. Vayishlach od sheinis. And so Avshalom tried a second time to send word to Yoav, V'lo ava lavo, and he refused to come. Yoav at this point realizes that David has, you know, kind of dug his heels into the ground, and David doesn't want to see Avshalom. Why? Now, Yoav might be thinking, time, right? How many years was Avshalom in Geshur? 3 years. It took him 3 years for the king finally to be ready to bring him back. So maybe he needs to be in the palace for 3 years, and then he'll see him. Again, we're dealing with complex emotions. Now, Yoav could have gone to Avshalom and told him that. Yoav, right? Velo, the pasuk says twice. Each time is velo ava lavo elav. He didn't want to come to him, meaning the Yoav refuses to even engage Avshalom in a dialogue to tell him no. Meaning, no is also an answer, but not giving an answer, that's most of the time that's worse, right? Most of the time we're more frustrated when we don't get an answer than when we get an answer of negative, because we can accept that and then plan accordingly. So Avshalom's really upset, and he's really upset at Yoav, and he does not know what to do. He makes a certain decision, and you know, I'll let you decide if it's the right decision. Pasuk Lamed, Vayomer al Avadav. Avshalom said to his servants, Re'u chalkas Yoav al Yadi. See, take a look, take a note at the portion of Yoav, the land of Yoav, El Yadi, which is next to mine. Apparently they had some fields. You have to imagine this is beyond the immediate palace. They had some fields, and Avshalom had a field that belonged to him, and Yoav was his next door neighbor in terms of the fields. Velo sham se'orim. He has some barley growing there, right? To him there's barley, se'orim. Lechu vatisua va'esh. Go and light his barley on fire. Vayatisu avdei Avshalom es chalka ba'esh. So they go, the servants of Avshalom go, and they light Yoav's farm, they light his crops on fire. That if you want to get someone's attention, this definitely works to get their attention. The question is it going to bring positive attention or negative attention? We could all imagine. Now, what's going to happen is we're going to have the actual dialogue and the effect of the dialogue. I mean, the actual dialogue is going to appear rather, I think we could say it's rather peaceful. But you have to imagine that however much, right, if you want to take the approach that one of the reasons why Yoav wanted to get Avshalom back was because he thought he was an asset, it was someone good to have around, you have to imagine this is going to totally sway Yoav in a different direction of realizing Avshalom is trouble. Some want to point out a similarity in terms of stories in Tanakh. Specifically, if we go with the approach that Avshalom was a Nazir, right? And here's a Nazir giving the advice of burning someone's field. So what other time in Tanakh?
Shimshon
HaGibor, in the time period of the Shoftim, was a Nazir. He was a Nazir also his whole life. A Nazir from birth. We have that in the Haftorah of Parshas Naso. And he burnt the fields of the Plishtim. So Like a lot of times when we point out similarities, the reason why we have similarities is to kind of highlight the difference. Right there, Shimshon was doing it to protect Klal Yisrael. Here, Avshalom is doing it. First of all, he's doing it to a fellow Jew, and Avshalom is doing it to push his own agenda, not anything else. The pasuk lamed aleph, vayakam Yoav. Yoav gets up, vayava Avshalom habaisa, and he comes to Avshalom's house. Vayomer elav, and he says to him, lama hitisu avodecha es achelka asher li ba'ish. Why did your servants burn down my portion, burn down my land with fire? Again, it almost doesn't sound like he's angry. It almost sounds like he's just saying, you know, like, why'd you do it? Pasuk lamed beis. Avshalom answers back. Vayomer Avshalom el Yoav. Avshalom says to Yoav, Hinei shalachti eilecha lemor. Behold, I sent to you saying, Bo, Bohena, come to me, come here. Ve'eshlecha uscha el amelech, and I want to send you, right? I was calling you to come here in order that I'll send you el amelech to the king lemor, saying, Lamavasi migishur. Why you, David? Why you, king? Why did you bring me back from Geshur? Tovli od anisham. It was better for me. Tovli od. It was good. It was even more good. Anisham. It was better for me to stay in Geshur. Vata ere pnei hamelech. And now, I would like to see ere. I should see pnei hamelech, the face of the king. V'im yesh bi avon, and if I'm guilty of sin, v'hem yisani, should put me to death. This limbo is driving me nuts. When he says that it would be better for him in Geshur, so it could be one of two things. Number one, it could have been that all the time that Avshalom is in Geshur, so we're not 100% how David feels about him. Right? It's still a little bit of a question. And therefore, there might have been people who have it out for Avshalom, but who say to themselves, I don't want, we can't mess with Avshalom because we don't really know his father's true feelings. And if David still has a soft spot for Avshalom, then we shouldn't bother Avshalom. But now he's saying, now that you've brought me back to the palace and we've gone 2 years with the king not seeing me, it's very clear that my father doesn't care about me, and therefore why would someone who wants to get me, could be any of my brothers want to get me because I killed Amnon, I'm unprotected. So it might have been better for me in Geshur. The other approach is this, to say, remember what Geshur is. Geshur is his maternal grandfather, who's the king. You have to imagine he's living like a king's grandson. He gets to see the king. He gets to eat in the dining room of the king. Right? Imagine they have glatt kosher meals for him. Everything's great. And here he's ostracized. So it would be much better for him to stay in Geshur. And he's reaching out to Yoav because he maybe knows about how Yoav wanted him to come back. And he's basically saying, did you want me to come back like this? Like, that can't be what you wanted. That can't be what was designed, that I would come back like this. And Yoav does not respond with anything negative. He doesn't complain again about the fact that Avshalom burnt the crops. He just takes it to heart, and he actually goes to the king in the next pasuk. In the back of our minds, we have to imagine that going forward, regardless of what Avshalom does, when Avshalom actually makes certain decisions in the future, we'll understand it more clearly. But kind of regardless what Avshalom does, you have to imagine that his stock, as I said, in the eyes of Yoav, has gone way down, and Yoav is not going to forget this episode of his field being burnt. And some of us might say rightfully so. This was totally, kind of out of line. Avshalom is saying, I had nothing else to, I'm desperate. Pasuk Lamed Gimel. Vayavo Yoav el HaMelech, so Yoav came to the king, vayaged lo, and he told him. Now, what did he tell him? We don't know. It could have been simple. He could have just told him the words of Avshalom, that he told him, Avshalom wants to see you. Avshalom says, why have I been brought back? It would have been better for me to stay there. I'd like to see my father, the king. Now, it could also be that Yoav opened up to David and said, there's something off with Avshalom. He just burnt down my crops to get this message across. So how much he tells him, we don't know. Vayikra el Avshalom. So David called Avshalom. Vayav el Amelech, and he came to the king. Vayishtachvulo. Avshalom bowed down to him, alpanov on his face, arza to the ground, lefnei hamelech. He bowed down to before the king. Vayishak hamelech l'Avshalom, and the king kissed Avshalom. And the story ended. There doesn't seem to be words. Probably what the emotion that's lacking, that's, right, if you recall the reunion between Yosef and Yaakov, granted it was more time, but there was tears. You would expect there to be some tears. It leads some to think that Vayishak HaMelech LeAvshalom is not an intimate type of kiss. It's not an emotional type of kiss. It's more like a formality, that has to be done. So the question is that how does Avshalom take it? That's the real question. Does Avshalom feel embraced or not? If Avshalom, right, so I imagine what leads Mefarshim to think that this kiss was more of just a formality is that if Avshalom felt fully embraced by his father, his next steps wouldn't be to start a rebellion, right? So Avshalom must feel like, okay, listen, Yoav did what he needed to do after I burnt his field. He got David to go out of his way and make a meeting between the two of us, and David extended a kiss, but it was not a warm embrace. And so Avshalom keeps what's boiling over in Avshalom's mind is, where do I go from here? What's my future? So Bez Hashem, next time we'll begin Perek Tezvav and see that.
Everything's a domino.